So, in the 19th century, Alexis de Tocqueville was a Frenchman who visited America, and he wrote this book that became very popular called Democracy in America. And it was this, you know, an outsider looking at the establishment of American democracy and just, you know, observing some things about what the American character involved, what they were like. You know, why did it turn out so well for America in relation to Europe, where the French Revolution produced democracy, but the one that quickly descended into terror as well. So in Democracy in America, de Tocqueville observed that while Americans were the freest and the most enlightened people in the world, they seemed forever dissatisfied. Quoting from him directly, he said, "They, as in Americans, are forever brooding over advantages they do not possess. It is strange to see with what feverish ardour the Americans pursue their own welfare, and to watch the vague dread that constantly torments them, lest they should not have chosen the restless path which may lead them to it." I beg your pardon, sorry. "To watch the vague dread that constantly torments them, lest they should not have chosen the shortest path which may lead them to it." So this vague dread that they could have been happier, says de Tocqueville, makes Americans restless in the midst of abundance. And I think this actually sounds a lot like our contemporary condition. The rates of depression, the psychologists tell us, are actually rising in the West. They've been increasing since the late 1950s, in fact, according to psychologist Martin Seligman. He also notes that depression is now affecting younger and younger people. In the 1960s, he tells us, the first onset of depression was about age 30. Now it's 15, might even be younger. Jean Twenge is an American psychologist, a psychology professor, and she wrote Generation Me, and that subtitle is Something to Behold, Why Today's Young Americans Are More Confident, Assertive, Entitled, and More Miserable Than Ever Before. Now, she notes that this trend of increasing depression is very striking among young kids as well. She observes that normal school children in the 1980s were actually more anxious than child psychiatric patients in the 50s, which is, you know, if that's true, then that's actually certainly very distressing to hear. Now, she's talking about the American context. I wonder, in some ways, do we follow that as well? And even though we can't be sure, it's certainly something to pay attention to. Now, I don't know about you, but I look at this and go, you know, isn't that strange that, you know, life should be fantastic right now? And yet, why are we more depressed as a result? So, I mean, we have so many advantages over earlier generations. We have better education, more opportunities. We have medical advances, better technology, more rights and opportunities. And, of course, we're free above all. But maybe we are too free in some senses. A psychologist, Barry Schwartz, recently wrote that he wrote of the tyranny of choice. And he's essentially arguing that too much choice is bad. He says that an overwhelming amount of choice leads to paralysis rather than liberation. If you have too many options, you're just like, I don't know how to choose. He also notes an interesting point as well, that we are less satisfied with the result than if we had fewer choices, because we are plagued by the imagined alternatives. So even if we're able to finally make a choice, this choice that I've gone with, you know, I can't feel good about it because it could have been better. This is his point. Now, going back to Dale Keane, whose work I've been talking about, he notes that uncertainty about who we are and who we might have been will exist for many people in the I world, because no one will ever be able to know with certainty if they have chosen the identity, the spouse, or career path that will maximise their happiness. So remember what I said in the first talk. The I world tells us to choose well and to create ourselves. The result that we're seeing is it's actually producing a lot of anxiety and depression because there's so much pressure to make the right choice. So what this tells us is that choice is both a privilege and a burden. It expands the possibilities, but it also makes us anxious because it's more stressful. Would I have been better off if I chose something else? Selfhood, the psychologists tell us, places an enormous amount of pressure on us to choose well, to make an enterprise of our lives. Jean Twenge, there's a quote in your handout. She writes, "Our growing tendency to put the self first leads to unparalleled freedom, but it also creates an enormous amount of pressure on us to stand alone. This is the downside of the focus on the self. When we are fiercely independent and self-sufficient, our disappointments loom large because we have nothing else to focus on." Now, Martin Seligman goes a little bit further than what Twenge just said. He actually links the increasing rates of depression with the decline of the T world. I mean, he's not a Christian, but he, when I came across this quartet of terms that he quotes, I was like, that's the T world. He says, as soon as the individual stops investing in God, nation, family, and duty, this produces more depression as a result. Now, I don't know about you, but I look at that and I'm like, that is fascinating. Because many of us today look at the T world and, you know, this idea of living for more than the self, and in some senses we see slavery. Okay, we see not the physical, not the act of enslaving other people, but this idea that the individual is trampled on in the name of the group, that the group is more valuable than the individual. We might think about women, for example, under patriarchy and go, it wasn't so great for them as well. They were limited in what they could do. And we also see in the T world this intolerance of difference as well, racism, sexism, and so on. And in the news in the last couple of weeks, there was a story reported, I think out of the UK, where this Pakistani girl was actually killed by her parents. Now, we look at that and we're horrified at that. You know, this is what we imagine of the T world, that this girl was killed by her parents because she was bringing shame upon them by seeking to date a non-Pakistani guy. So that's the horror story that we see of the T world. You know, we kind of look at it in that way and go, oh, that's horrible. We don't want any part of that. However, what's really apparent is that we've swung too far in the opposite direction. Now it's all about me. And as we can see, focusing on the self and its desires in the I world isn't exactly freedom either. In fact, it's more anxious. So this is why I think we are more restless, even in the midst of abundance. Now, last session we were talking about the vertical self, the Christian vertical self, who recognizes that their life and their identity is shaped by the story of God's grace rather than the I world. Now, this makes Christians a story-formed community, Stanley Hauerwas's term. It makes them a story-formed community. You know, what do I mean by that? I mean that in telling stories together, we come to know our shared past. We recollect it in memory. We reaffirm it in the way that we live our lives, and we anticipate it as we move toward the future. Okay, so the story of Jesus is, well, even going further back from that, God's creation of the world, God's intervention into the world to save a wayward humanity, and God's wrapping it all up at the end of time. That is the story that should frame our lives and everything that we do. So as a community, we are to constantly refer back to that, because that's going to give us our meaning, our identity, and also our direction in the world. Now, in talking about direction in this sense, what I want to convey for you today is that this is to make us pilgrims, okay? Now, earlier, if you remember, I talked about how tourism is something of a metaphor for modern life. Tourists are constantly on the go. They're never settling in one place, but they're always sampling experiences, cultures, places, people, and then moving on. For postmodern tourists, the search is everything and discovery matters little. And stated another way, it's better to travel hopefully rather than arrive. Now, these sorts of postmodern touristic attitudes prize the postmodern idea that all truth is relative. It's important to keep an open mind. But Oz Guinness argues that true seekers are looking for something, and that hopeful travel is travel that actually hopes to arrive at a destination. So the figure of the pilgrim we can set alongside the figure of the tourist. In some ways, the tourist is the horizontal self, the pilgrim is the vertical self. Like the tourist, the pilgrim's on the move, but they're not moving simply for the sake of moving and because they're fearful of, you know, arrival. Rather, pilgrims are always locating themselves in relation to their final destination. So they're vertical selves because there is a bigger story, a bigger picture that orients their movement in the world. So in a culture in which mobility is all important, God's not calling us to be still. He's actually calling us to move with purpose towards him. And in that sense, we also have a predecessor who was moving and moved in relation to God's call, and that is Abraham. Abraham is the first pilgrim called by God to leave his land, his culture, and his people for the sake of his future self. God's command is quite similar in some ways, but very different to the I world. The I world says, depart and leave where you've come from, step outside that network of relationships of obligation in order to create and fulfill yourself. Whereas God says that Abraham must be prepared to leave everything he knows in order to grasp his identity in God. And note that this isn't the self-made identity of the citizen of the I world. It's actually an identity discovered in God, from where it's an identity that goes from father to father of many. Abraham's ultimate allegiance was to God, and this orients the activity of all of his life. And if that's the case for Abraham, then it should be the case for Christians as a pilgrim people. Now, the Croatian theologian Miroslav Volf tells the story of Abraham to make the point that moving in response to God's call helps us to cultivate the proper relation between distance from the culture and belonging to it. So it helps us to think about how we, you know, are to belong to our culture, but also be distinguished from it as well. Because being too close to the I world, belonging to the culture, means there is no difference between the Christian and the non-Christian. And that, you know, we can be Christian tourists as well, constantly sampling but never actually making a commitment. But at the same time, being too distant from the I world isn't the better option either. Because firstly, you won't be able to communicate with the people who are living in the I world. And secondly, therefore, you are useless to the world that God is slowly but surely redeeming. God, my point here, is that God is active in the I world, and how else are you going to get on board with what he's doing unless you're there as well? So Wolf's solution to this is that Christians are to depart and yet belong. He says, when Christians respond to the call of the gospel, they step, as it were, with one foot outside their own culture while the other remains firmly planted in it. They are distant and yet they belong. Their difference is internal to the culture. So he can be a little bit, you know, hard to grasp, but he's basically saying you're standing in two worlds, okay, the I world and in God's future. That's actually where you as a Christian need to be. Doesn't mean that you should grab from here and grab from here and try and combine, but you're in this world, the I world, so you can be more effective for God's world. Now, Stephen Boomer Prediger and Brian Walsh look to the figure of the sojourner, okay? And it's their version of the pilgrim, as I've been talking about. They say that the sojourner loves her place without clinging to it. She knows the art of loving this world, of deeply caring for it and making a welcoming home in it, but without grasping at our provisional home as if it were our final home. Okay, so you love the world without clinging to it. Now, as Christian pilgrims or sojourners, our difference will be internal to the culture through our calling. Okay, we are called by God just as Abraham was. Now, Oz Guinness, in his book The Call, writes that calling is the truth that God calls us to himself so decisively that everything we are, everything we do, and everything we have is invested with a special devotion and dynamism lived out as a response to his summons and service. Oz Guinness goes further, saying that there's two kinds of call that we're talking about, okay? There's the primary calling, which is alluded to in Romans 8:30. God is calling us to himself, so we're called by God to be his people, to become a Christian. However, we also have a secondary calling, this idea that everything we do is a response to his summons, in everything we should think, speak, live, and act entirely for him. Now, calling makes up those two aspects, okay? So your calling and my calling is to fulfill our secondary call in response to God's first primary call. Now, the first thing to say about this is that being called presumes a caller, right? Someone is calling you. It's quite interesting in life. I want to show you, say, two questions, and it's interesting how we can track the move from the T world to the I world in just the distinguished in just these two questions. The question, what's your calling in life? That's the first one. The second one is, what do you want to be when you grow up? Now, what's your calling in life? Implies that the individual has been in some ways chosen or nominated or elected to fulfill some sort of higher purpose. They've been commissioned in some senses to do something by someone, right, who's greater than the individual and who calls that person to do that. Whereas the question, what do you want to be when you grow up, is very I world. And we, you know, often speak in that language without even realizing there's that T world, I world distinction going on. This question, what do you want to be when you grow up, focuses on the individual and their desires, their plans, and their dreams. Now, the steady secularization of our culture can be glimpsed in the replacement of that first question about calling with the second question about what do you want to be when you grow up. So that's the first thing to mention about calling, that there is a caller. Now, I want to spend some time looking at the idea of vocation, okay? Today, this idea of calling and vocation is linked to the work that you do. For example, vocational training, right? It's about training you up to enter the workforce. Now, this use of vocation is actually also a secularization of a religious concept. Vocation is derived from the Latin term vocare, I think that's how you say it. Now, that means to call, but then, you know, who's calling? For the Christian, God is calling, right? Which is why vocation was often used when someone was going to enter the ministry. But the Reformation challenged this idea that only the priesthood and, you know, nuns and monks, for example, had callings. Martin Luther said that the works of monks and priests, however holy and arduous they be, do not differ one whit in the sight of God from the works of the rustic labourer in the field or the woman going about her household tasks. So the idea here is that everyone can honour God with their lives, whether in very impressive lines of work or very ordinary and day-to-day lines of work. There's no first and second class Christian among us. You know, this, there's often that idea that if you're in a church, the ministry workers, they're like, oh, they're quite important. And then the rest of us who are maybe out making coffee for other people, that's not as important. Well, God is saying, Luther is saying that everyone can honour God in whatever they do. At the same time, we also learn that calling is not the same as work because, Os Guinness says, vocations never end, even when occupations do. It's more accurate to say that calling and vocation is linked with your life purpose and inextricably bound up with your individual identity. So it's not so much about the work you do, but who you are, what's your purpose. Guinness puts it this way. The thing is to understand myself, to see what God really wants me to do. The thing is to find a truth which is true for me, to find the idea for which I can live and die. So the idea here is that you need to find something that you can really stake yourself on. And it's clear to me, and I hope it's clear to you guys as well, that, you know, we all have a purpose. We've all been equipped differently. When we use them to glorify God, we become more ourselves than we ever were before. Andrew Cameron writes in his book that he doesn't say this in relation to calling, but he says that the idea is to have a Jesus-shaped version of ourselves. And I'm arguing today that through our calling, we can become that. Now, this Jesus-shaped version of ourselves doesn't trample on our individuality as the T-world might, but it actually redeems it, makes it more effective, deepens it, widens it, etc., and makes it effective for God. And we can see glimpses of this in 2 Corinthians, for example, that says that we are a new creation in Christ. All that was before is going to be transformed, redeemed, renewed in Christ. And it's also pictured in Revelation when Jesus gives his followers a white stone. And on that stone, a new name is inscribed that no one knows except the one who receives it. So that's truly who you are, okay? Right now, we're in the process of becoming that as we are on pilgrimage in the I world, but one day it'll all make sense and we will be more ourselves than we ever were before. So what should we do with our callings? I'd like to have you consider the following examples. Now, Steve Jobs gave the commencement address at Stanford University in 2005. And in some ways, the extracts from this speech have become quite legendary. If you go on motivational websites to try and, you know, inspire the work that you're doing, you'll often see quotes that have been plucked out of this speech to encourage you. So I've got two selections here. Firstly, Steve Jobs says, "You've got to find what you love. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking. Don't settle." Secondly, "Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. Everything else is secondary." So keep that in your mind as we move to another one. This is J.K. Rowling, author of Harry Potter. In 2008, she gave a commencement address to Harvard University. And in this address, she spoke about the power of imagination. And she defined that as not only the power to imagine what isn't, but also the power to empathise with humans whose experiences we have never shared. So you'd think when she's talking about the power of imagination, she's going to talk about how you can write a best-selling novel that dreams up a whole new world. But she says, no, the power of imagination is to empathise with other people, to imagine what life is like for them. And in relation to this, she spoke about the experience of working at Amnesty International when she was younger, and she was hearing all the time these really terrible stories of suffering and persecution because people had dared to speak up against the brutality of their governments. So she exhorts the Harvard crowd in front of her to use their power for the good of other people. She says, "Choose to use your status and influence to raise your voice on behalf of those who have no voice. Choose to identify not only with the powerful, but with the powerless. Retain the ability to imagine yourself into the lives of those who do not have your advantages." So when we put the two alongside each other, we see an interesting contrast. Steve Jobs says that it's most important to follow your dreams. That in some ways is his version of calling, even though he doesn't believe in God. He says it's most important to follow your dreams, whereas Rowling says it's most important to lift up other people, to identify with the powerless. Now, when I hear Steve Jobs say that, I'm like, that's really inspirational, right? But in some ways, it is straight out of the I world in its assumption that the individual is all important. And if we take what he says to its logical extreme, we can see that it's something of a statement of radical individualism that presents freedom in negative terms. Okay, I've got on your handout, freedom from. That's this negative framing of freedom. Freedom from the demands of other people. That's the way that Steve Jobs figures freedom. So in other words, don't let other people get in the way of your dreams. Forget everyone else. It's about you. Be uncompromising when it comes to your ambitions. Be free from the demands of other people. That's what Steve Jobs is talking about. We see, however, Rowling depicting freedom in positive terms, what I call freedom for. She encourages these future change makers to use their gifts in the service of other people, to use their freedom for other people. Now, I'm not sure if J.K. Rowling is a Christian, but her message is an example of humility, of Christian humility. I know you've had John Dixon here. He's written this great book called Humilitas, and he's talking about how humility is a Christian virtue and how it enters the culture through Jesus Christ. At a specific historical moment, before then, to be humble was to be degraded and to be low, and you would never want to be that. So yeah, humility, you can trace that back to the Christian tradition. And in Humilitas, John Dixon defines humility as using your influence for the good of other people before yourself, or serving other people with your talents. The important point here is that the purpose of being gifted, okay, of being called by God, is this idea of stewardship and service, not selfishness. So in this sense, our gifts are actually for other people, for the benefit of others. They're to be used in that freedom for model rather than that freedom from model, which is that I world way. Freedom for is all about service and humility, and it is that in echo of Jesus. In Philippians, we learn that even though Jesus was up here with God, he lowered himself and took the lowest position and went even beyond that by dying for humans in order to bring them back home, essentially. So what might this look like for us Christians today? Well, the posture of the Christian towards the world is one of hospitality. In light of the knowledge that whenever we care for the needy, we actually show hospitality to Christ himself, as we learn in Matthew 25. So Tim Keller observes that people, you know, in some ways, could not only spend their money on themselves, but spend themselves on other people by working against injustice, by sharing food, clothing, resources. So this idea of people spending themselves on other people rather than spending their money is countercultural. Okay, think about how the iWorld says, seek your own good above that of others, that Steve Jobs style attitude. The gospel, however, says, seek the good of your neighbour. And even though we don't need our good works in order to be right with God, our neighbours need our good works. So service and humility is very important when we're on pilgrimage in the iWorld. Keller also says that the only way to reweave and strengthen the fabric of human community is by weaving yourself into it. Reweaving shalom means to sacrificially thread, lace, and press your time, goods, power, and resources into the lives and needs of others. Okay, so he says the human community is like a fabric and everyone needs to be woven into it. Think how that contrasts with the community that's created by Facebook, where it's like only your friends or only the people that you like, whereas we're talking about community for everyone, not just whoever's on the social network. And when he talks about shalom, he's talking about this sense of complete reconciliation, perfection itself, the fullest flourishing in every dimension. There's also another reason, however, why we are to seek the good of our neighbours and to reweave ourselves into the human community. Vuma Prediger and Walsh say that the homeland for which the sojourner yearns is not some other world, but this world redeemed and transformed. This is why Christian sojourners are aching visionaries who bear witness to and work for a future of shalom. Okay? So the human community requires us to weave ourselves into it because this world is important. We're not going to just junk this one and move to heaven 2.0, right? When God's reign begins in its fullest sense. This world is what we have, which is why we are to work with God in redeeming it, in echo of the final redemption that is to come. Now, I've written, well, you didn't. I'm not sure if you got the blurb for this particular talk, but I was talking how I want to move on to the last point about longing for home and how longing for home, this idea of that final destination, helps us orient ourselves in the iWorld today. Now, C.S. Lewis, I've used him a lot this in these talks, he observes that if people really looked into their hearts, they would actually realise that what they want very badly, like desire, really cherish, is something that can't be had in this world. He says that there are all sorts of things that this world promises to give us, but they never quite keep their promise. Quoting directly from Lewis, he says, the longings that arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of a foreign country, or take up some subject that excites us, are longings that no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. Now, when he says that, he's talking about a particular thing that the scholars have called Sehnsucht. Okay, it's a German term for longing and yearning and has overtones of nostalgia. And this idea that we desire something but we are alienated from it, we're not close to it. And so he's, and in lots of C.S. Lewis' work, he talks about this longing that for something that can't be had in this world. Now, he argues in Mere Christianity that if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, then maybe I was made for another world entirely. Some atheists will say, well, you just have that longing, that's just the human condition, but it's like, well, no, if we're a Christian, then maybe God has planted a seed in us, and that longing that we have is for heaven, right? It's for God's reality. Now, what is this desire, this longing, this yearning? Whoops. Well, this is a quote from C.S. Lewis's book Till We Have Faces. It's his retelling of the story of Cupid and Psyche. And this is what Psyche says. She says, "The sweetest thing in all my life has been the longing to reach the mountain, to find the place where all the beauty came from, my country, the place where I ought to have been born. Do you think it all meant nothing, all the longing for home? For indeed it feels now not like going, but like going back. All my life, the God of the mountain has been wooing me." And I wonder if you feel like that as well. All your life, the God of the mountain has been wooing you. He's been calling you home, essentially. So what we learn from this particular quote is that there's a longing for home in all of us that we feel most acutely. And we think, if we can step back for a moment and go, well, what does home mean to us, right? I've done some reading about this, and what I've gathered is that home is the place we fully belong. Well, we fully belong to, and it fully belongs to us. It's also a place where we can know and truly be known. Okay, in the narrative of the Garden of Eden, it's that idea of being naked but not ashamed, full, unguarded access and intimacy with each other. And it's also a place where we can rest, finally, in contrast to the restlessness that plagues us as we live today. Now, Frederick Buechner notes that the home that we long for and belong to is finally where Christ is. Home is Christ's kingdom, which exists both within us and among us as we wend our prodigal ways through the world in search of it. So as Christian pilgrims in journeying through the world, we are to travel hopefully, right, in search of our destination, seeking to live out our callings, to love our neighbours as we head to the heavenly city that is spoken of in Hebrews. Because just like Abraham, we're looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose builder and architect is God. Now, the writer of Hebrews, I mean, it's an incredible chapter. I love it so much. But what he writes in there is that all these people, all these heroes of the faith, never actually received exactly what they wanted, right? They were looking to the heavenly city of the future. In the writer's words, people know that they're aliens and strangers on earth, and people who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. And God, in fact, has prepared a city for them that they can actually call their own. Now, because we are looking for this country, right, of our own, where we are truly at home, truly at rest, helps us to live now in this world and to love it without clinging to it, because we know what is to come. But we also know that the time is now to start living in light of that. Now, living, just as final words, living in the I world as a Christian pilgrim is hard because, of course, there are plenty of distractions along the way. Now, since the I world has discarded any meaning that arises beyond the self, it's in some ways given up the hope of a destination. Instead, the I world says that it's only the journey that matters, the endless wandering of the tourist. That is where people are in the I world today. But I've argued today that the destination matters just as much as the journey, because our heavenly home gives shape to the way that we live our lives now. It gives shape, it gives direction. It also provides hope as well for our final home. So I hope that you are encouraged that God is with you every step of the way, and that he is pleased to use you and I for his glory in whatever we do, which is an enormous amount of responsibility, but then we also know that we're not alone in this as well. So as you go on pilgrimage in the I world, I pray that you seek those opportunities to glorify God in whatever you do, because, as Buechner says, there's treasure buried in the field of every one of our days, even the bleakest or dullest, and it's our business as we journey to keep our eyes peeled for it. Thank you very much.